What I thought I would do is just share with you some important and poignant episodes taken out of some what we might call American classics. We can debate if we want to, as we read and as I read and as we respond to the readings, what makes up a classic, if you want to do that, or we can talk about some major themes that run through African American literature. Just to get us started, I thought I would suggest three kind of generalizations that we can look for as we hear what goes on in these different episodes. For sure, one of the major themes that runs through African American literature is the acts of physical oppression. And that goes, I mean, from slave narratives and on up, we're talking about beatings and rapes and shackles and later on lynchings. And that's a part of it. It's the reality, it's the historical reality of the African-American experience in America. There is also something that I think we can call a social oppression that might be without or apart from this physical oppression. It's possible to be socially oppressed, as we all know, without necessarily being physically oppressed. And the last one, and I think the one that makes us begin to understand what makes a classic, is the complexity of what I'm going to call spiritual oppression. And we'll look for those kinds of things as we and just talk about what we see in these different episodes. I had a couple of phrases here that I'd also like to just put down. And one of them is that these books deal with social issues. And then something I've called, for lack of better words, either alter, as in other, or meta, physical issues. And in pretty fancy words for, you know, I call them on freshman English things, don't give me the 25-cent words, let's have something that's simple and concrete. But we're going to see clearly some social issues brought up in the episodes I read. Hi. We're also going to see, but I think it's more subtle, but it's also perhaps more long-lasting, more pervasive, and it gets into the difficulties of understanding what racism is, what we're calling these alter or other than physical experiences, beyond the physical. And we'll look at all those and have some interesting times doing that, I think. Anybody ever heard of Uncle Tom's Children? Guess where the name comes from. Uncle Tom's Cabin, right. And these are, who are we talking about? The
children.
The children, good, yeah. That's all the heart of the questions are, right there. You know, that was a test. And who are Uncle Tom's children? They're the children of Uncle Tom. Okay, in this book, written in 1938, Richard Wright kind of hits the scene. This is before, you may have heard of Black Boy, you may have heard of Native Son. It's before those two great American classics come out. This kind of sets Richard Wright up as somebody to be noticed in the American literature scene. And I'll share this with you. For lots of you, it might be your first, maybe not, encounter with African American literature, but this was my first encounter with African American literature. I was lying on the beach at just outside a grass beach by a little bitty man-made lake. By Eugene, Oregon, reading Uncle Tom's Children. And the first story I read, when I finished it, I just set it down and had to rest. I was exhausted. And I read another story, and I never read more than one at a time without resting. And they had that kind of an effect on me, and then I could go on, but I won't, and how these stories here actually changed my whole life in terms of how I saw literature and how I thought literature should be taught. Well, there are some fun scenes in here that, fun I'm using loosely. The first episode that I'm going to read from is from a section called The Ethics of Living Jim Crow. It's kind of ironic that this book was first published in 1938 with four stories in it. Big Boy Leaves, doesn't matter what they are, with four stories. And then after that became moderately popular, he added a final story, and a sort of autobiographical essay, which is, if you've read Black Boy, lots of similarities between this short essay, The Ethics of Living Jim Crow, and the autobiographical stuff in Blackboard. He added that. I think he added that to lend credibility to the fiction that is here. And my last word about that is, you know, I've had students say, well, it's just fiction. Anybody want to respond to that? Even English teachers can. Anybody. It's just fiction.
Has to come from somewhere.
Yeah, that's a great response. It does come from somewhere. And it comes from where?
It comes from real life.
From real life and from out of those experiences of the writer. And that's a great answer, and we understand that already. So fiction tells the truth. And whether that is historically, for the moment, accurate or not, really is irrelevant. It's a truth, and it's a different kind of truth than historical, though we'll see how it's surely representative of historical truth. This is a short section from that autobiographical sketch. Negroes who have lived south know the dread of being caught alone upon the streets in white neighborhoods after the sun has set. In such a simple situation as this, the plight of the Negro in America is graphically symbolized. While white strangers may be in these neighborhoods trying to get home, they can pass unmolested. But the color of a Negro's skin makes him easily recognizable, makes him suspect, converts him into a defenseless target. Late one Saturday night, I made some deliveries in a white neighborhood. I was pedaling my bicycle back to the store as fast as I could when a police car, swerving toward me, jammed me into the curbing. "Get down and put your hands up," the policeman ordered. I did. They climbed out of the car, guns drawn, faces set, and advanced slowly. "Keep still," they ordered. I reached my hands higher. They searched my pockets and packages. They seemed dissatisfied and they could find nothing incriminating. Finally, one of them said, "Boy, tell your boss not to send you out in white neighborhoods after sundown." As usual, I said, "Yes, sir." End of episode. What do you make of that? They get more poignant, by the way. As usual, I said, "Yes, sir." Does anybody know anybody, or has anybody in here ever had that kind of experience?
You get stopped for a ticket.
Stopped for a speeding ticket. And what happens to you?
"Yes, sir."
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. We do, don't we? I've never been stopped. Treat you on your neck. The one you have to see. Okay, for sure, and that's a good analogy, that we've been stopped and we say, "Yes, sir," because we're afraid of the law. Anybody else? Do you know anybody? I teach at a seminary every other summer, and it's a seminary that's trying to incorporate lots of different theological considerations, and three of the colleagues that were at the seminary 3 summers ago in Holland, Michigan, were African-American. And the four of us, on the 4th of July, went out to celebrate the 4th of July. And we had a great little time, drank some Pepsi, and one of those guys might have had a beer either. And we just had a great social time together. And then I went home because my family was going to take off for the beach at Lake Michigan. And the next, that was a Friday. The next day, I saw my 3 African-American friends in Holland, Michigan. One of them has a PhD from Union Theological School. The other two have master's degrees from Fuller Seminary, and are youth workers. And all three of those guys, just walking through the streets of Holland, had been circled by the police for 3 hours. No one stopped them. As usual, I said, "Yes, sir." It's a different, what do you call that? I mean, we have words that we use commonly in our language. I mean, that's harassment, isn't it? And even though no one gets stopped, no one gets picked up. Anybody else have examples like that? Well, we'll move on. Where would you categorize that? It surely isn't physical. I mean, this isn't either.
Social.
And what kinds of things does that say about our society and its willingness to oppress? As soon as I asked that, I knew it was a bad question. What do you see in that kind of, "Put your hands up!" And they go through his bags and they're disappointed they don't find anything. So one of the social kinds of oppression is just intimidation. And it can get pretty subtle, can it?
And pretty blatant.
And it can get pretty blatant too. Yeah, good. I have a colleague at Augustana where I teach who is African American, and he's married to a white woman. He's a former Kansas City Chiefs football player. He's big, he's strong, and he's very, very dark. When he goes into Kmart in the wonderful Quad Cities of the Iowa and Illinois, he goes into Kmart by himself, someone always, he tells me, comes up and says, "Can I help you?" Very nicely. And then they'll kind of just walk with him. If he's with his wife, no one ever offers to help him. You know how that makes him feel? He's been stopped twice for driving home. Just stop. What are you doing here? This is in the Quad Cities in 1993. What are you doing here? He says, "Well, officer, I just live up the block." "Oh, sorry, didn't mean to bother you." And he moves on. But how does, my friend's name is Cecil, how does he feel? Well, let's look at some of the historical perspectives that bring about, we may not see this kind of physical oppression now. Though, there was a woman here, anybody here go to any of Dorothy Hall's sessions last 2 weeks in the staff at all? She talked about, she was here from Chicago working with Urban Studies program, and she talked about riding with her mother and her brother. Her brother has a real good temper, and her brother's job, I'll let you know about that later. But the three of them are driving through a pretty white suburb of Chicago, and they're not speeding, but they get pulled over. And the cop walks up, flashes his badge in there, and there's three black people in the car, and says, "What are you doing here? Show us your license." And Dorothy said, "Mama, we're going to get killed right now because her brother has such a temper." Well, right, he slammed the door, he stood up, he walked out, he slammed the door first, he pushed the cop back, pulled out his, he said, "I am the chief of police of this county, and you just stopped the wrong guy." "Sorry, officer, sorry." And they got back in their police car and off they went. But what they tried to do, and Dorothy joked about it, but, "Mama, we're going to get killed." There's something historical to that that made her even respond that way. Well, here's Richard Wright in this wonderful story, Big Boy Leaves Home. Big Boy Leaves Home is a story of just a bunch of four little kids who are about 12, 13, or 14 years old, and they decide to skip school. And they skip school, and they're playing a lot of fun and games, and they decide to go swimming. And there's a sign at the swimming hole that says, "No trespassing." Now they know what that means. As one of the kids says, "You know that means no niggers and no dogs." They're kids. Let's go. It's hot. And it's been established for about 6 pages in this short story, just the art of Richard Wright, how young these kids are, how innocent they are. "Oh, your mama don't wear no shoes," and they're playing the dozens, and they're having fun, and they're rolling in the grass, and they're throwing rocks, and they're talking about who broke wind the loudest and the smelliest. And it's clear that they're little kids, that they're innocent, but they know something in their innocence about their history. Because just before this episode of Swimming in the Swimming Hole occurs, they talk about, as they hear the train whistle go by, "Hey, that's headed up north. I wonder what's up north." And just in a brief, just a glimpse of a discussion about, they wonder about up north. They're sensitive already as little kids to the differences between the south and the north. And some kind of, if it's just an unconsciousness, I don't know, but some kind of awareness of oppression and life that could be different. Well, they go swimming. And a woman, who apparently owns the land, comes down, she's white of course if she owns the land, comes down and catches them in their swimming hole, or in her swimming hole, and there's no swimming allowed, of course. There's an image that we have here. Here's this sign, and this sign says no trespassing. The woman comes down, the kids know right away, there's four naked black boys in a puddle of water, in a pool of water, and there's a white woman standing there beside them. They're scared. Anybody know anything about why especially they should be afraid? Because they're naked?
Because studying and doing something, or besides just being naked, doing something to the light.
Yeah, exactly. They're little kids, and it's clear. That's why the first five pages talk about their, you know, their games and stuff. It's clear they're little kids, but still, they're naked and they're around a white woman, and there's a whole lot of part of what goes on with this idea of social oppression is how we live myths. And I don't use that in a literary sense. I use that in just a sense of a myth as in something that's not true. Well, lady, we want to get our clothes. Buck and Lester climbed the embankment and stood indecisively. Big boy ran toward the tree. Jim! The woman screamed. Jim! Jim! Black and naked, big boy stopped 3 feet from her. We want to get our clothes, he said again, his words coming mechanically. He made a motion. You go away! You go away! I tell you, you go away! Big boy stopped again, afraid. Bobo ran and snatched the clothes. Buck and Lester tried to grab theirs out of his hands. You go away! You go away! The woman screamed. Let's go! Said Bobo, running toward the woods. Crack! The sound of a rifle. Lester grunted, stiffened, and pitched forward. His forehead struck a toe of the woman's shoes. Bobo stopped, clutching the clothes. Buck whirled. Big boy stared at Lester, his lips moving. He's got a gun. He's got a gun! Yelled Buck, running wildly. Crack! Buck stopped at the edge of the embankment, his head jerked backward, his body arched stiffly to one side. He toppled headlong, sending up a shower of bright spray to the sunlight. The creek bubbled. Big boy and Bobo backed away, their eyes fastened fearfully on a white man who was running toward them. He had a rifle and wore an army officer's uniform. He ran to the woman's side, grabbed her hand. Are you hurt, Bertha? Are you hurt? She just stared at him and did not answer. The man turned quickly. His face was red. He raised the rifle and pointed at Bobo. Bobo ran back, holding the clothes in front of his chest. Don't shoot me, mister. Don't shoot me. Remember how old these kids are. Big boy lunged for the rifle, grabbing the barrel. You black son of a bitch! Big boy clung desperately. Let go, you black bastard! The barrel pointed skyward. Crack! The white man, taller and heavier, flung Big boy to the ground. Bobo dropped the clothes, ran up, and jumped onto the white man's back. You black sons of bitches! The white man released the rifle, jerked Bobo to the ground, and began to batter the naked boy with his fists. Then Big boy swung, striking the man in the mouth with the barrel. His teeth caved in, and he fell, dazed. Bobo was on his feet. Come on, Big boy, let's go! Breathing hard, the white man got up and faced Big boy. His lips were trembling, his neck and chin wet with blood. He spoke quietly. Give me that gun, boy. It's not the end of the scene, but in a way it is. What do you make of that much so far? And let me help you out. Don't worry about intellectual answers. All great literature starts here, in your guts. You know, and how do you, just how does that make you feel? We'll get to your head, maybe, and if we don't, who cares?
Scared.
You're scared. Good.
Angry.
Huh?
Tense.
Yeah, for sure. We just, let's go. Big boy, let's go.
Yeah. Bewildered.
Okay, let's explain. That's a good answer, too. Let's explain some of these feelings, the anger, the bewilderment, the tenseness. What causes that? And I'm not looking for literary, I mean, well, when he says this, I just mean in you.
The kids don't have any way out.
Oh, great. So,
trapped.
Start of this is, one of the ways, yeah, is entrapment. And they're trapped. There is no way out. And there's no way out of what? You haven't read much now, just that little bit. There's no way out of, not only this spot, out of this hole, but... The whole dilemma, and the dilemma has to do...
Out of the South, I mean, it's the whole thing.
Yeah, well, great, the South. The whole idea of what they think about black boys and white women. And there's no way out. Did he hurt you, Bertha? The first lesson they had, they're little kids. Did he hurt you? And not only are they little, but they're naked, and that certainly adds to their vulnerability. Yeah, anything else? Where does that tense come from? Or where does the bewilderment come from? Maybe only one person had
to believe that's happening.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's what happened to me. This little Anglo-Saxon white honky boy from northern Minnesota read this book and said, I can't believe this. And I put it down and thought, yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, it's just also out of proportion.
It's a great answer, too. It is out of proportion, cruel, unusual punishment. They're swimming, they're trespassing in a water hole, and they're going to get killed for that? Watch this as we go through rights experiences and lots of African-American experiences, that the choices for characters very often comes down to this, physical or spiritual survival. If I'm going to survive physically, I'm going to surrender all that I am as a human being. Or if I'm going to survive spiritually with strength and self-will and determination, I'm probably going to get shot or killed or somehow physically dead.
I don't think those categories are so easily separated and defined, because the physical and social oppression causes the person experiencing it to ask some very serious questions about who I am in relationship to God and God's protection of me, or God's allowing these things to happen to me. Am I really worthless like people say I am?
Yep.
Is my life so invaluable that at the drop of a hat, or in this case, swimming naked in somebody else's pool or pond can result in the loss of my life, when a simple ticket or even going to jail, if a fine, whatever, for trespassing is in order.
Yep. Note, this is the beginning of what in African American literature is called protest literature, officially. Slave narratives were protest literature too. But Wright kind of brings about that name. And the first story in protest literature is this kind of poignancy and power and out of that much out of proportion, as at your phrase. That's the first one. I mean, somebody's got something in mind, I think, with that, and maybe we'll touch on that as we go too. But it's really important from the beginning, as you now say, to pull all three of these together, that they can never, sometimes this happens without this, because it's so subtle that you know, there are no chains there. I asked my students in African American literature class after we've been in there for a while, now, I want you to just list the ways that you can be enslaved. And I'm not talking about shackles on your wrists. How else can you be enslaved? And the answers, of course, cover the whole spectrum of our being. And we begin to understand that. I remember that day sitting on the beach of Eugene, Oregon, give me that gun, boy, and I wrote it in my book. To think that he would. You get what I'm asking? This white guy has just killed two of his friends, beat the hell out of the other one. It's obvious how cheap life is. And he says, give me the gun, boy, expecting him to do it. Right? Where does that rank in this social, spiritual, physical oppression? And there's no right answer to that, but I want you to think of it in that dimension. Give me the gun. I said so. And I'm white. And you're black. He spoke quietly. Give me that gun, boy.
How about food?
Yeah, first of all, he's stupid. That's right. But he has a certain mindset in his way of living, doesn't he? What is it?
Mike makes right.
It's a great answer. And my might isn't even the gun, because he doesn't have it. His might lies in what? His might lies in what? And he's white. Yeah. And in his history of whiteness that they know well. Well, let's watch how this ends. Big boy leveled the rifle and backed away. The white man advanced. Boy, I say, give me that gun. Bobo had the clothes in his arms. Run, big boy, run. The man came at big boy. I'll kill you. "I'll kill you," said Big Boy. His fingers fumbled for the trigger. The man stopped, blinked, spat blood. His eyes were bewildered. His face whitened. Suddenly he lunged for the rifle, his hands outstretched. Crack! He fell forward on his face. "Jim!" Big Boy and Bobo turned in surprise to look at the woman. "Jim!" she screamed again and fell weakly at the foot of the tree. Big Boy dropped the rifle, his eyes wide. He looked around. Bobo was crying and clutching his clothes. "Big Boy! Big Boy! Big Boy!" Big Boy looked at the rifle, started to pick it up, but didn't. He seemed at a loss. He looked at Lester, then at the white man. His eyes followed a thin stream of blood that seeped to the ground. "You killed him," mumbled Bobo. "Let's go home." Naked, they turned and ran toward the woods. When they reached the barbed wire fence, they stopped. "Let's get our clothes on," said Big Boy. They slipped quickly into overalls. Bobo held Lester's and Buck's clothes. "What are we going to do with these?" Big Boy stared. His hands twitched. "Leave them." They climbed the fence and ran to the woods. Vines and leaves twitched their faces, and once Bobo tripped and fell. "Come on," said Big Boy. "I'm scared." "Come on, don't cry. We want to get home before they catches us." "I'm scared." "Come on." The scene is over. Well, they go home. "We want to get home before they catches us." They come home. The first person they see is Bobo goes to his home, and Big Boy goes to his. And Big Boy meets his mother. "What's the matter, Big Boy?" Mutely, he looked at her. Then he burst into tears. Again, remember how little these kids are. She came and felt the scratches on his face. "What happened to you, Big Boy? Somebody been bothering you?" "They after me, Ma, they after me." "Who?" "Big Boy, what's wrong with you?" "He killed Lester and Buck," he muttered simply. "Killed?" "Yes, Lester and Buck," she says. "Lester and Buck?" "Yes, Ma." "How killed?" "He shot him, Ma." "Lord God in heaven, have mercy on us all. This is more trouble, more trouble," she moaned, wringing her hands. "And I killed him, Ma." She stared, trying to understand. "What happened, Big Boy?" "We tried to get our clothes from the tree." "What tree?" "We were swimming, Ma, and the white woman." "White woman?" End of that scene. What do you make of that? What are the crimes? Two kids are dead. Big Boy has killed a white man. Unforgivable. She knows what's going to happen. They're going to lynch anybody they can find. They're going to burn houses. They're going to go crazy. The white folks are. And what does she say?
White woman.
White woman. Listen to how that gets lifted up even more. She says to her daughter, "Go get your pa," I say. Pa comes in. I'm skipping some things. Pa comes in. "What's Big Boy into now?" "Saul, Big Boy's them got into a lot of trouble with the white folks." The old man's mouth dropped and he looked from one to the other. "Saul, we got to get him away from here now. Open your mouth and talk. What you been doing?" The old man gripped Big Boy's shoulders and peered at the scratches on his face. "Me and Lester and Buck and Bobo was on an old man Harvey's place swimming." "Saul, it's a white woman." Big Boy winced. End of scene. So twice we've heard that. What do you make of that?
There's no way out.
Again, how trapped he is. There's no way out. What do you make? Again, your guts. You don't even have to know history. You don't have to know what's going on in the rest of the story. What do you make of this episode that emphasizes it's a white woman twice, and that seems to be more important that there are two dead kids and one dead man?
The incredible assumptions of it.
There you go. And that's a nice phrase way to put it. The incredible assumptions that go along with that. And let's talk about what some of those assumptions are in this context of physical, social, and spiritual oppression. Horrors. What are some of those assumptions?
That the black kids are in the wrong.
For sure. No matter what, they're in the wrong. Good.
And that many, many lives may be lost as a result of the way it's all perceive.
Under this physical stuff, oops. I'm writing the words you can't read. Arbitrary. And how arbitrary the revenge is going to be. And just anybody, what they'll say is, just get an ear. Get any ear, let's just get. And only they don't get one. They'll go to a house and they do burn down Big Boy's house.
It's like one of those times when the Klan would rise.
Yep. The Klan would be hot. Good.
A white woman will be vindicated above all else.
Great observation. Said as succinctly as you can say it. A white woman will be vindicated above all else. We don't worry about, well, it's self-defense. Should we try that in court? A white woman will be vindicated above all else. Well, it was an accident. It was manslaughter, not murder. A white woman will be vindicated above all else. I mean, can we go to the jury, go to the sheriff, go to the judge, go to the, what kind of systems are out there for this kid to appeal to?
Well, what I want to know is, can you find a defense lawyer who will really be a defense lawyer?
Sure. Another question, the entrapment. Well, you see how one episode becomes, it wraps up all three of these ideas. Let's just think for a second about how does that affect the spirit? I don't know if I had these down to write. I didn't. So I'll just tell you what goes on. Pardon me?
Despair.
Okay, I'll write that down, because that's what comes out of the spiritual, is there's despair. And Saul and Mrs. Big Boy, Big Boy's mom and dad decide they have only one thing to do with their 13-year-old kid. Now think of your own, if you got one 13-year-old kid, your 13-year-old brother or sister, when you were 13, you're ready to leave home and just goodbye, huh? They decide the only way out for Big Boy is to ship him out. They know that the Saul's brother is coming by with a truck tomorrow, and if he can get him on that truck, he's going north. He's got a load of grain to take up north, and they're going to put their kid on the truck and goodbye. You got to get him out of here, never to see him again. They say that, they know that, and they do that. And the last scene of the story is Big Boy's on the truck, and the blades of sun are coming through the cracks and the boards on the side of the truck. It ends there. That's despair. It's also, I think, adopting a whole philosophy of fatalism. Nothing we can do. And the fatalism comes from, there's no lawyer that's going to defend him, honestly. So all of the institutions and the symbols of the establishment are out there, and they're going to stand against this kid. So, and they know that. So they don't say those options that we might think of. Well, come on, we're going to take you down to court right now, and I'm your dad, and I'm going to speak up for you. Well, dad can't do it, but we get you a lawyer. The lawyer can't do it, but the jury will do it, and the jury won't do it, and you get the point. Anything else about it? So we've got two words here that are a part of the spirit, and then maybe even, yeah.
What about tenacity or persistence or something? Because if despair implies hopelessness and no way out, and yet these people found a way out, it meant saying goodbye to their son, but that was the only way of saving his life.
Tenacity, and your other word was?
Persistence.
Persistence.
Despite the despair.
Courage.
They hung in there.
Yeah.
Courage, yeah.
Yep.
Courage despite despair.
Well, and that's true. That's a major ingredient, characteristic of characters in African American literature, that these kinds of character traits rise up. But that doesn't diminish the power of this kind of oppression in me either. But it's still, yeah.
Well, there's still going to be some consequences to be paid. They probably don't even know who this kid is, but you know, there's probably a whole bunch of kids in that town, same age,
yeah,
same size, so they don't care. Even though he's gone, somebody's going to pay for it.
And the consequences of being tenacious and being courageous and being persistent are always, we'll watch these stories on, are always manifest in violence. And the violence in this case, in this story, is always physical. There are other kinds of violence too. Anybody else? Any other? Yeah.
Well, the feeling of the kid himself is just completely being abandoned. I mean, it's tossed, he's grown off of an uncle, but he doesn't know where.
Yeah.
And so just a total lost feeling, losing touch with all of them. Anything that he can count on, he's just being tossed out.
Yeah, great observation. And think what that adds to the idea of the value of his own life. You know, the cheap. Yeah, that's really good.
Jim is dead too, and it reminds one, this might be spiritual part, but sin is self-destructive. That there is a prejudice, or there are assumptions within the white community about these black children that led the man to do what he did, and then to die as a result himself.
It's a good point. The evil within this guy caused. Yeah, that's right. That's good. Well, let's go on to see how this 12-year-old handles part of this, and imagine. Let your imagination go with this scene. Big boy has to leave the house. He has to pick up this truck the next day, so he's got to hide somewhere. And he and those other three guys, Bobo, Buck, and Lester, have been playing in the side of the hill, digging holes in this hill right by the railroad track. And they've called them kilns. And he thinks that's the only safe place to hide. I mean, he knows he can't be at home. They're going to come there. And they do. They come, and their other story is that they burn his house down. They get a hold of Bobo, and they lynch him, they castrate him, they cut off his body parts, and they sell him for souvenirs, and they advertise all that stuff. And it's all historical stuff, and we don't have to, you know, this fiction is true. Okay, we know that kind of thing happened. Well, Big Boy's off. He stopped at the foot of the hill, trying to choose between two patches of black kilns high above him. He went to the left, for there lay the ones he, Bobo, Lester, and Buck had dug only last week. He looked around again. The landscape was bare. He climbed the embankment and stood before a row of black pits sinking 4 and 5 feet deep into the earth. I can't get my kids when they're little to walk upstairs in the house in the dark. And this little kid has to go dig, you know, bury himself in these holes. I want to set that up again, set the next sentence up by repeating the one I just read. He climbed the embankment and stood before a row of black pits sinking 4 and 5 feet deep into the earth. He went to the largest and peered in. He stiffened when his ears caught the sound of a whir, and he ran back a few steps and poised on his toes. A 6-foot of snake slid out of the pit and went into coil. Big Boy looked around wildly for a stick. He ran down the slope, peering into the grass. He stumbled over a tree limb. He picked it up, tested it by striking it against the ground. Warily, he crept back up the slope, his stick poised. That's not the end, but what do you make of just that?
Everything's out to get him.
Yeah, okay, everything's out to get him, and he sure is feeling, man, what else? Good. What would you do? You're just out there looking around out here in the tailings, and you're going to sleep there, take a little nap, and there's a little hole, and you get, oh, it's a snake. Well, I'll just look at the snake, come back, kill him, and crawl in anyway. What would you do? You're out of there, right? Well, why isn't he?
He has no
place to go. And what does that say about already at 12 a sense of history even? You take on a snake or you take on what's coming. And he knows what's coming. It isn't even it isn't even a choice for it. He sees the snake, he goes out, I gotta get a stick. And when about 7 feet from the snake, he stopped and waved the stick. The coil grew tighter, the whir sounded louder, and the flat head reared to strike. He went to the right, and the flat head followed him, the blue-black tongue darting forth. He went to the left, and the flat head followed him there, too. He stopped, teeth clenched. He had to kill the snake, just had to kill him. This is the safest pit on the hillside. So he waved the stick again, looking at the snake before, thinking of a mob behind. There it is. The flat head reared higher. With stick over shoulder, he jumped in, swinging. The stick sang through the air, catching the snake on the side of the head, sweeping him out of coil. There was a brown, writhing mass, and then Big Boy was upon him, pounding blows home, one on top of the other. He fought viciously, his eyes red, his teeth bared in a snarl. He beat till the snake lay still, then he stomped it with his feet, grinding its head into the dirt. He stopped, limp, wet. The corners of his lips were white with spittle. He spat and shuddered. Let your imagination go now. Cautiously, he went to the hole and peered. He longed for a match. He imagined whole nests of them in there waiting. He put the stick into the hole and waved it around. Stooping, he peered again. It must be all right. He looked over the hillside, his eyes coming back to the dead snake. Then he got to his knees and backed slowly into the hole. Well, there's another wonderful story in this collection called Long Black Song. And here's some of the greatest dialect, I think, in American literature. Like I've read everything in American literature, what do I know? But it's pretty good stuff anyway. And this is the story of Silas, who is, Silas and Sarah are married, and Silas has done everything right. I mean, he's bought land, and he's really made it, and he doesn't let his wife work, and then he keeps her home, and she talks about that. She said, all the other black women have to work, and I'm here, I'm able to take care of my child, and Silas is making money, and he's selling his cotton, and he's in town now. And while he's in town selling his cotton and really making a good deal, and he comes back, in fact, and tells her, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get me a hired man. Isn't that what the white folks do? I mean, he is making it economically in this system. And he's doing all the, he's playing by all the right rules. Well, that skips ahead. While he's in town, Sarah, who apparently is a seductive, attractive young woman, is home alone, and she's recalling some moments that she had with Tom, who is Silas's brother, who was a good friend of hers and also someone that she loved. And it's implied, perhaps, maybe she had sex with him, we don't know that. But she's in this kind of longing, romantic reverie, just thinking about Tom. She loves Silas, and she's true to Silas. Well, in this mood, up comes a white college kid who's got a summer job selling radios, phonographs. And he says, Annie, what else do you call her? It's like calling the guy boy. Want to buy a radio? He's got no money to buy no radio. Well, they're pretty nice. And they get in this, they talk and talk and talk. And she thinks all along, this is a white guy, you know, and I don't like being alone here talking to this guy. Well, he makes, and this is an ironic story, I think, in that we already know that the white woman will be vindicated no matter what, but now we've got a black woman, and so to speak, to make it glib, the shoe's on the other foot, and now we see another set of assumptions rolling out, and those set of assumptions are by this white college kid, I think I can make you a deal on this radio. Guess what? The deal is. Well, it's not clear in this story. It depends, I think it has a lot to do with whether you're a woman or a man reading this story, and that's an interesting kind of discussion if you read this and discuss. It's not clear whether she's raped or whether she's seduced. My own interpretation of this argues well, I think, that she is raped. And it's not such a physical overpowering because she's mostly afraid that this is a white guy, and what can I do anyway? So the rape doesn't occur, she's not all beaten up and bloody, and in fact it happens inside the house. I mean, she kind of drags her in, and she kind of goes along, and she's not willing, and anyway, that's enough. And it's left in the story, deliberately ambiguous, but as you consider that, it's ambiguous because I think you see her in her mind the power of this white guy and all of his assumptions about black and white power, and male and female power, and all kinds of assumptions go on there. Silas, he leaves. He drops the price on the radio. He just crosses the number out, $50, and puts it down to 40. And Silas sees that and says, well, what's the deal? How come? And he starts to get suspicious. Finally, he finds in the bed a handkerchief that is wet with fluids, male and female fluids. And he finds that, and he gets... Well, here's his wonderful, here's a literary word for you. It's kind of I know of no word that says it better. This scene is filled with pathos. It's not pathetic. You can't use it in the adjective. It's not pathetic. It's full of pathos, intense feeling and power. And Silas was as good to her as any black man could be to a black woman. Most of the black women worked in the field as croppers, but Silas had given her her own home, and that was more than many others had done for their women. Yeah, she knew how Silas felt. Always, he had said, he was as good as any white man. He had worked hard and saved his money and bought a farm so he could grow his own crops like white men. Silas hates white folks. Lord, he sure hates them. He learns that what I told you. Let's see. I've mixed up something here. Okay. He learns about this whole thing. Tells her. He also understands. He thinks it's betrayal, but he also understands the power of the white man to rape. And he doesn't entirely blame her, but he blames her. But most of all, and you'll hear in this soliloquy, almost in a second, he waits for the white guy to come back and pick up his money the next day, and he kills him. And there's two of them together, and Silas just stays in the house, and the guy comes up, and he blows him away. Well, the other, he doesn't get both of them. The other guy goes, gets in the car, and takes off. And, well, of course, then they come back. And he wants to save Sarah's life, and he says, get your things and go to Aunt Peel's. You get out of here. And she says, in this episode, in fact, she says, come with me. And he refuses. Unlike Big Boy, and unlike a whole society that forcibly had to surrender to the status quo, we can't fight it, he chooses to die. But before he does, get your things and go to Aunt Peel's. Let's both go, Silas. I'm staying here till they come back. She grabbed his arm and he slapped her hand away. She dropped to the edge of the porch and sat looking at the ground. Go away, she said quietly. Go away before they comes. I didn't mean no harm. Go away for what? They'll kill you. It don't make no difference. He looked out over the sun-filled fields. For 10 years I'll slave my life out to get my farm free. His voice broke off. His lips moved as though 1,000 words were spilling silently out of his mouth, as though he did not have breath enough to give them sound. He looked to the sky and then back to the dust. Now it's all gone. Gone. If I run away, I ain't got nothing. If I stay and fight, I ain't got nothing. It don't make no difference which way I go. God, God, I wish all them white folks was dead. Dead, I tell you. I wish God would kill them all. She watched him run a few steps and stopped. His throat swelled. He lifted his hands to his face. His fingers trembled. And then he bent to the ground and cried. She touched his shoulders. Silas. He stood up. She saw he was staring at the white man's body lying in the dust in the middle of the road. She watched him walk over to it. He began to talk to no one in particular. He simply stood over the dead white man and talked out of his life, out of a deep and final sense that now it was all over and nothing could make any difference. The white folks ain't never give me a chance. They ain't never given no black man a chance. There ain't nothing in your whole life you can keep from them. They take your land, they take your freedom, they take your woman, and then they take your life. He turned to her screaming. And then I get stabbed in the back by my own blood. When my eyes is on the white folks to keep them from killing me, my own blood trips me up. He knelt in the dust again and sobbed. After a bit, he looked to the sky, his face wet with tears. I'm going to be hard like they is. So help me God, I'm going to be hard. And when they come for me, I'm going to be here. And when they get up, and when they get me out of here, they's going to know I'm gone. If God lets me live, I'm going to make them feel it. But Lord, I don't want to be this way. Can you see why? You got to rest after one of those. And you see in that scene, without even, it needs no words, I guess, the incredible complexity of spiritual and social and physical oppression and what it does to the whole metaphysical, other than physical, outlook on life. And as we read and come in touch with that, we get a sense of, I think, what literature does, is we're connected to that in a way that we can't get connected otherwise. I mean, through reading history books or sociological studies or things, we somehow feel of a character that's developed for us. Anybody have anything they want to say, though? Sure, yeah.
I want to say how easy it is to become what you hate, or to become like that which is hated,
yeah,
or despised.
It's a great line, isn't it? Lord, I don't want to be this way. Yeah, thank you. Anybody else? Well, on a lighter note, and you know, somebody, it was a woman, mother, asked me, you teach African-American literature and it's so full of despair. How do you, I don't want my kid coming out despairing. And I'll share with you what I shared with her so you understand what African-American literature does. It's more complicated than this, but if a writer didn't believe in hope and in change, she wouldn't bother to write the book. He would surrender to the fatalism that somebody wants imposed upon us, and the artist says, the visionary, the prophet says, no, I'm going to write. And out of that art comes this sense of, and it automatically, I think, makes that art political, because it suggests, learn, feel, whatever, but I'm going to write this, and I'm not going to allow myself or you to despair. Here's a wonderful book by a better known as a poet, Langston Hughes, but it's a great story, and if you're looking for stuff for your kids to read or you to read too, it's a story of a little boy growing up in Stanton, Kansas, and there's two scenes that are worth all of our hearing, and they go real fast, and I can do it in our time. Sandy is the name of the protagonist, the hero of the story, and there's two scenes here that connect. They're far apart in the book, but they connect, and you'll get the point. Sandy's going to school, the first time he's been to a racially mixed school. Take seats, all of you now, please, she rasped out. Anywhere now until we get order, she rapped again impatiently with a ruler. Take seats at once. So the children each selected a desk and sat down. Then the teacher, middle-aged and wearing glasses, passed out tiny slips of paper to each child in the front row, so that every student received one slip. Now, write your names on the paper, turning it long ways. Nothing but your names. That's all I want today. You'll receive forms to fill out later, but I want to get your names now for seating. Amid much confusion and borrowing of pencils, the slips were finally signed in big, awkward letters and collected by the teacher. Then she went to her desk, and there was a delightful period of whispering and wriggling as she sorted the slips. Finally, she finished. Now, she said, each child rise as I call out your name so I can see who you are. The teacher stood up with the papers in her hand. Mary Atkins, Carl Dietrich, Josephine Evans, she called slowly, glancing up after each name. Franklin Rhodes, James Rogers, that's Sandy's real name. Sandy stood up quickly. Ethel Shortledge, Rowan Thomas. The roll call continued, each child standing until he had been identified, then sitting down again. Now, the teacher said, everybody rise and make a line around the walls. Quietly, no talking, as I call your names this time, take seats in order, starting with number one in the first row near the window. Mary Atkins, Carl Dietrich. The roll was repeated, each child taking a seat as she had commanded. When all but four of the children were seated, the two colored girls and Sandy still were standing. Albert Zwick, she said, and the last white child sat down in his place. Now, you three colored children take the seats behind Albert. You girls take the first two, and you, pointing to Sandy, take the last one. Now, I'm going to put on the board the list of books to buy, and I want you all to copy them correctly, and everybody got it, right? The scene? Okay. There's another scene where Sandy, still in the fifth grade, is going to go to see the carnival that's in town. And there's going to be Ferris wheels and cotton candy and so on. He has been cutting coupons out of the newspaper for 2 weeks because this is such a big event. It's been advertised and the kids are going to go and they have school called off and it's a great thing. Willie Mae is his little black friend girl who's going to go with him. And so Earl is his little friend who is white. And they're all going to be there, and that's the only characters you really need to know. They started out. And Aunt Hagar is really Sandy's grandmother, and that's who he lives with. They started out. Here, called Aunt Hagar. Ain't you going to take your coupons? In his rush to get away, Sandy, so excited, had forgotten them. It was a long walk to the park, and Willie Mae stopped and took off her shoes and stockings and carried them in her hands until she got near the gate, and then put them back on again, limped bravely along, clutching her precious bits of newspaper. That's those coupons. They could hear the band playing and children shouting and squealing as the cars on the chute-de-chutes shot down over the splash into the pond. They could see the giant Ferris wheel, larger than the one the carnival had had, circling high in the air. "I'm going to ride on that first," said Sandy. There were crowds of children under the bright red and white wooden shelter at the park. They were lining up at the gate, laughing, merry, clean little white children, pushing and yelling and giggling amiably, black children. Sandy let Willie Mae go first, and he got in line behind her. The band was playing gaily inside. They were almost to the entrance now. There were just two boys in front of them. Willie Mae held out her black little hand, clutching the coupons. They moved forward. The man looked down. "Sorry," he said, not unkindly. "This party's for white kids." End of part of the scene. It goes on a couple pages before this, the excitement and the anticipation built up in these little kids to be able to go to this. And there's no physical, other than keeping them out, but he didn't touch them. And he said, not unkindly, "Sorry, this is for white folks." White folks. And you get the sense of how that connects. There's a complicated, Hughes puts in a complicated dimension to this scene, though. The little kids complain, and one of them says, "I'm going to go home and tell my dad to come here and kill that guy." And Sandy says, "Well, maybe you can." And there's that kind of discussion. But then Earl, their little white friend, comes up. "What's the matter, Sandy? Ain't you going in?" Earl demanded that, looking at his friend's worried face. "Did Willie Mae hurt her foot?" "No," said Sandy. "We just ain't going in. Here, Earl, you can have my coupons. If you have extra ones, the paper says you can get more lemonade, and so you take them." The white boy, puzzled, accepted the offered coupons, stood dumbly for a moment, wondering what to say to his brown friend, and then went on into the park. Now it is over. What do you make of those scenes? Anything? I mean, of course, but state even the obvious. Don't think that oh, that's obvious. You know, say anything you want. The woman, the teacher, first of all. Hopeless, right? I mean, we all know that. Come on. And what are her options? Skip ahead, since we're out of time. We've got 2 minutes.
She seems to start out seating the children in alphabetical order according to their names.
Right.
But then she gets to the swagback guy, you know, the black kids who Rogers, I think you said the
yep.
first name.
In the middle Rogers. Somewhere, yep.
Yeah, so I mean, she just didn't have any sense of justice.
Right.
But racial justice.
Is she the one to be blamed, though? Or is she a product of the system and the environment that she grew up in, I'm assuming, in the South?
Okay. I think that's the great question, and let's jump that same question up to the guy at the gate. He said, not unkindly. He didn't say, "Get out of here, you little brat." He said, "Sorry," as nicely as he could. "This party's for white kids." Let's talk about his options, and then let's ask that question that we will not be able to resolve here, I don't think. Who's responsible for that? I mean, do you blame him? But what are his options? He doesn't have to keep those kids out, does he? He might lose his job, but that's an option. He just chose not to do that. So one of his options is, "Hey, you guys go on in there and to hell with my job, and this is wrong, and I quit, and you get in there and have a good time." What are some other options he has?
We also wonder if he does let the kids in, what's going to happen to them once they get inside of the room and back to the park.
Yep. So it's for their own good. I mean, don't wonder you're going to be done.
It's for your own good.
You're right.
When the teacher sees them too, she, like you say, she was going by alphabetical order, but with the black kids, she did it by girls and then the boys.
Yeah.
And she didn't name them either.
Didn't even give them names? Good. Well, that's good stuff. You caught all that. Good.
Okay. I'm from Southern California, but in 1966, my wife and I were taking a trip across the country. I was in the service and I was coming back to Los Angeles. And we were driving through the South. We happened to stop in a small southern town, went into a five and dime to get something. And on the way out, I opened the door to allow this black lady to walk through the door, and her mouth opened, her eyes got big, her mouth dropped to the floor, and it was like I committed this social sin that could get her into trouble, and also me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just an innocent passing through.
Yeah.
And it seemed like the whole world right around there stopped. So it was like neither of us had an option in what to do.
What a wonderful illustration, in the sense that such an innocent, everyday, common act, big deal. And your phrase, the whole world stopped. Yeah. James Baldwin says, your heaven and earth gets disturbed, and no one can handle that. That's the difference of looking at, you know, Andy's teaching different theology for some of us, and then when our world gets disturbed, we stop. Well, a question to Lee. Yeah, go ahead.
Are they given, my wife, by the way, let's get out of here.
Yeah.
Are we given some indication as to what era this is?
Well, yeah, you are. And it's written, the Not Without Laughter, this is written in 1938. Not Without Laughter is written in 1934.
I think one thing that was really hard to hear was just sort of that at the end of the story when he gives away the coupons, it's sort of like he's ashamed.
He doesn't tell, that's right, and that's really important to get there. He doesn't say, oh, no, we're just not going in. He could say, that white bastard won't let me, you know, he could blame somebody. But where does the blame come? He's internalized all that. Yeah, that's really a good point.
And
that's
even more poignant because he's kind to the white kid, and the white kid doesn't know what to do.
Yeah.
That's the last for the white kid, that, you know, his friends can't go with him. Earl is kind of the receiver of all these coupons, but not...
Yeah, that's good. A question that, as you say about Earl, that I come away with there, we can criticize this guy at the gate and say, you know, you could have given up your job, you could have done a lot of things, or do we not blame him, and we blame the society, whoever the heck that is, and, you know, and which is pretty easy, we can dump this blame on some institutional that nobody has responsibility for. Or then we can look at Earl and we expect, well, come on, he's only 10 years old. Does he understand racism and prejudice and all that kind of stuff? No. And the question, I've read that story many, many times. And every time I read it, I stop and I wrestle with it again and again and again. Okay, Earl's at 10, let's say. And let's say that gatekeeper's at 40. Somewhere in between there, we get some consciousness. And at what point do we begin to be responsible for our role in this society? If it ain't Earl, I use ain't to emphasize the negative, he's 10. Well, where is it then? 21? 50? Or when is it when you, well, I've just been to college. Well, okay, now I'm out in the working world and I'm busy. There are geographic points, professional, I mean, career points, just plain age, knowledge, whatever, I mean, all the things that come blasting at us as to make us what we are. And all of these things keep coming and put the arrows in.